Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Living History. A good episode coming up today. A chat with a good mate of mine, Michael Malkinton, who is a historian. You would have certainly read his books, particularly if you're into aviation in the First World War. You might have seen him many years ago on a documentary that we did together called Lost in Flanders, but I just wanted to get him in here to talk about all things history. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. It's been a while since we've sat down and done this.
It is. You've been on the podcast a few times, mate. You've talked about a few things. Well, let's tell people. Tell them a little bit about you, what you're working on now. You've written a couple of fantastic books. You're a history teacher. Just tell everyone a little bit about what your story and what you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, sure. So, I'm a history teacher. I'm an educator. Recently taken a leadership position in a new school. Which, you know, it's been a really interesting and exciting journey for me. Still finding a bit of time to write, though. So at the moment, working on two things. So one of them, I'm with a colleague writing a book on the Pacific War, mainly for upper high school age students doing their HSC.
What aspects of the Pacific War?
Sort of follows the syllabus for the modern history course pretty closely, which I must admit is very American-centric. It sort of looks at the Pacific in isolation. And I suppose one of the things our research has pointed to is the importance of the broader context of the global war and, you know, the war in Asia, the war in Japan's war in China as well. So
Does China rate a mention? Because it's probably the one of the most important, I think, but overlooked parts of the Civil War.
Look, sadly not in the course that the New South Wales Education Standards Authority has put out, which I think is a bit of a flaw in it, but we do touch on it in the book because it is important to understanding.
Is that going to be distributed just to students, or where's that going to go?
It's certainly predominantly aimed at students, yeah. And the other book project I'm working on at the moment is a history of the Southern Cloud disaster. So in 1931, Australia's first really significant civil aviation disaster. Passenger airplane went missing over the Snowy Mountains and remained missing for 3 decades.
Really?
Until it was discovered, in the 1950s by a Snowy Hydro worker. I've actually tracked him down and interviewed him for the book. He's quite an elderly gentleman now. And yeah, that book's coming together just looking at that accident, but the broader story of the very early days of air travel in Australia.
How did you get into this? You're now typecast as a specialist on aviation and warfare. Has that been a passion of yours your whole life?
It has. I grew up reading Biggles and gluing together Airfix model kits, which I think is probably how most people who end up doing aviation history get started,
That's great. When are we going to see that book? Is it Southern Cloud?
Southern Cloud. Yeah, look, it's probably, to be honest, a couple of years away at the moment, just where I'm at with my life with young kids and stepping up into a new role in my career. But it's also something I'm really committed to doing well because there's yet to be, I think, the book on the topic. So, yeah, I'm happy to take my time with that
one. Well, yeah, it's an amazing story. I'm looking forward to reading that one. I wanted to get you in today just to talk about a few topics of history that have been around. Basically, you and I have chatted about many of these things over a beer, and I thought it would be good to get you in and just have a chat about things happening in history. Let's start with something that I think people will relate to, Masters of the Air. The series has just finished on Apple TV+. we've had a few chats about it. Where did you land at the end? I know that when we first started talking about it, when one or two episodes had come out, you were quite impressed. Has it held your attention for 9 episodes?
Yeah. So can I just say, I really was looking forward to this series. I read Donald Miller's book, The Mighty Eighth, that it's based on.
Yeah.
Maybe 10 years ago. You know, I'd read it a long time ago. I admired the book. I'm a huge fan of Band of Brothers and the Pacific. I think they were outstanding. That was outstanding storytelling about, you know, men at war on television. And I was literally counting down the days until Masters of the Air appeared. I've got to say, after 9 episodes, though, Matt, I'm a bit underwhelmed by the whole thing, and I feel a little bit let down and a little bit disappointed by it.
I've got to be a little bit cautious here because we are going to have Donald Miller on the podcast very soon to talk about his absolutely outstanding book, so I should be a little bit judicious in what I say about it, but I think I share that sentiment. It seemed a little bit all over the place. It seemed at the start to spend no time on character development. It was all action. But then by the second half, it was all character and very little action. So it seemed quite disjointed to me in the end.
Yeah, look, let me be clear and say, again, I think Donald Miller's book is first-class history. I mean, it's thoroughly researched. It's absolutely authoritative.
He's a great writer as well.
Great writer, but so accessible. And it's a great story.
I loved his description in the probably on the first page where he talked about when he's talking about Norfolk and where they were all based, how it jutted out into the channel like the head of an axe. And I thought it was just such an amazing metaphor to talk about. You know, obviously, this is the point where the war is being launched on Nazi Germany. And that was a fantastic metaphor. That grabbed me on probably the first page.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so much of that. You know, his descriptions of obviously aerial combat. But well beyond that, I mean, something that sticks in my mind is his treatment of the so-called flak farms, you know, where they were sending these bomber crews to try and have a bit of R&R and recover. But really, it probably, you know, wasn't all that effective because then they're going back to their bases. Look, I think that there were a few things about the series that let me down. One thing that I struggled to get past was the CGI. And I can't put my finger on it, but it just didn't look right to me.
Well, this is an issue that the previous two series, I know this isn't a trilogy, this is not the third in a trilogy, Hanks and Spielberg and team are simply making miniseries when they think it's a good idea. But this one had an issue that the other two didn't, is that all of the action had to be computer generated. The scenes of the actors was them sitting in a shell that was in a soundstage in Hollywood. It was already starting with a certain lack of authenticity, and I think it struggled to overcome that throughout the series.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I couldn't help but keep thinking about one of my favorite movies growing up was Memphis Belle, which I think was made in about 1990. And from what I understand, they made that film with, you know, a few airworthy B-17s and, you know, a handful of Mustangs maybe, and basically models and practical effects. And I felt that gave a far more engaging and engrossing picture of what it was to be like on one of these missions over Nazi Germany in 1943 or 44 than anything that Masters of the Air did with 30 extra years of technology and CGI. And I don't know exactly why that is, but for me, it just didn't quite look right in the air-to-air combat scenes. The other thing I think that, and which you mentioned before, was just how diffused the story was. And again, Donald Miller's book is a remarkable piece of historical research and a great read. But I do wonder if it was the right book to then build a television series out of and produce a screenplay, because Donald Miller's book is not about the 100th. The 100th bomb group features prominently, but it's a book about the whole 8th Air Force, and it deals with everything from the philosophy of strategic bombing before the war. It deals with the moral questions. It deals with the Luftwaffe's, you know, defensive tactics and how they changed over time. I mean, it's quite a comprehensive book, and I almost feel that in using that, I wonder if the screenwriters then tried to cover too much ground.
Well, they had to keep dipping in to bits of the book to tell their story, and that's what it felt like. You know,
yeah.
Probably the best example is Rosie Rosenthal, one of the great heroes of the book, one of the great heroes of the Second World War from an American perspective. But he was kind of hardly introduced. Then he's in this, his most heroic mission where he single-handedly was almost in a dogfight with half the Luftwaffe.
Mm.
And then sort of skipped ahead what he'd done 25 missions. And, you know, there was this, there was the scene where he, you know, sorry about spoilers, but I hope everyone's seen it by now. But there was a scene where he was then on R&R. So they talked about that aspect of it. And the next thing, he's 25 missions and coming back in. Then he became almost the central character later in the whole thing. So I thought it was, I thought it was a little bit disjointed. The other thing I was missing, Michael, which I felt was there was. I mean, it's, I know it's a TV, it's entertainment, it's not documentary, but they didn't seem to answer the question of why. Why are these guys going up all the time? What targets are, like, what are they bombing? The moral question was barely touched on. They skirted around it a little bit. The moral question, when we talk about that, we mean the huge you know, psychological pressures that were on aircrew, the thought they're dropping these bombs and killing people on the ground, and in many cases civilians. They didn't really touch on why. That, and it was a very specific thing that the Americans were doing compared to the British, who were carpet bombing cities, you know, reaping the whirlwind. But I thought that, again, it's not a documentary, but they didn't seem to be an understanding for me as to why they were doing this. And I am someone who knows the history of the Second World War and what was trying to be achieved. But yeah, I thought it was very fragmented. It was difficult to follow. It was hard to keep up with the characters. Mm. I posted this online when I did a review about it early on, and a lot of people have made the point that, well, they're probably just trying to reflect the fact that there was a lot of turnover of crews, you know, and that's being reflected in the series, that you meet someone and they disappear in the same episode. I do get that, but I don't think that's what was going on. I think it's just poor, you know, I think it's just poor narrative is really what I think, that you couldn't feel a connection. I would have loved to have seen, for example, a Kurahi equivalent episode showing these young, enthusiastic blokes who'd all dreamed of flying, to fly a B-17. I mean, imagine what that journey was like, even just to introduce them. I would have loved to have seen, you know, a Buck or a Bucky when they were young blokes. Oh, you know, how, you know, first flights and how does, and them learning their skills, because we sort of parachuted in when you had these crews who were very technically qualified and very skilled, which they were by the time they got to the European theatre. These crews were very well trained. I would have loved, just loved to have seen from a character development point of view what motivated them to join the Air Force, because that was a huge part of it. It was a huge part of Donald Miller's book, that they grew up seeing planes.
And Lindbergh, a lot of them, and,
yeah, and a lot of them came from rural areas of America where, you know, the closest they ever got to a plane was a crop duster flying over, or, you know, and the, but they had this passion. The, almost universally, the guys that flew with the Army Air Forces had this passion for flight, and that's why they ended up doing it, because they joined the Army, and then they were sort of siphoned off as the brightest and best to, in the early days. To join the Air Force. So, I think it suffered a little bit from just sort of being parachuted in with them ready to go, and we miss out on that character development.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think in some ways the screenwriters probably had an easier gig with Band of Brothers. You know, Stephen Ambrose's book, when you read that book now, it's almost like it follows, or well, the screenwriters followed it so closely, it's almost like it was written for months. The screen.
It's 10 months. No disrespect to the airborne guys that land on D-Day. But they landed in June 44 and the war ended in May 45.
You're right. It's a concentrated period of time. It's a concentrated group of men. And land warfare must be so much easier to depict on the screen than air warfare, you know?
And you don't need CGI. You can do with extras and...
That's right. You know, and they're not wearing oxygen masks, you know? So it's easier even in terms of acting. Yeah. I've read some criticisms about the acting. I actually thought it was pretty good in Masters of the Air. But, you know...
I think Austin... What's his name? Austin Butler.
Yeah.
I heard that after that he's such a character actor that, I don't know if this is true, my 19-year-old daughter told me this, that he's such a character actor that when he did Elvis, he went so deep into Elvis that he had to actually go and get, like, go and see a counselor to try and undo the work because he thought he was Elvis almost. I don't know if that's true. I've probably misquoted that my daughter Brooke told me. But I thought we were watching Elvis. He was just like, yeah, thank you very much. I'm going to drop these bombs out and get on home. Thank you very much. It was Elvis. It was Elvis in the cockpit of a plane.
There was a bit of that. Can I just say, though, two things that really I admired about the show and two aspects of it that kept me going even despite some other disappointments. The first one was the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid episode. I thought as a single episode, it was written brilliantly. I actually watched that with my wife, who isn't a historian. And I actually, after the briefing, paused it and just said, did you catch what was going on there? Which might sound a bit condescending of me, but I didn't ask it in a condescending way. I really wanted her to enjoy this and for us to watch it together. And she absolutely did. They did a brilliant job in explaining...
Ball bearing factories. They love their ball bearings, the Americans.
Yes, but just how the plan was supposed to work and then obviously the impact of the weather. That and then the air-to-air combat scenes in that were harrowing. I've read some criticism about the speed at which the German fighter interceptors, the Fokker Wolfs and the Messerschmitts, fly through the formations. Absolutely. I mean, you've got to remember these aircraft are flying at each other at hundreds of kilometres an hour.
And head-to-head was the Luftwaffe way to deal with the B-17s. They were least armoured on the front.
Nose on, and they would have...
So they were passing at huge speeds.
Absolutely. And the amount of time that the Luftwaffe pilots would be within range, or the B-17 gunners would be within range to fire an effective burst, we're talking 1 or 2 seconds, and then they're gone.
It's also the most effective way to kill the pilot, which is obviously going to bring the plane down if you smash the pilot up. So the Luftwaffe had the correct strategy, but it meant that for the belly gunners and the tail gunners, it was a brief glimpse of a plane.
Brief glimpse, like a flash pass. And I think they really nailed that.
Yeah,
the other part of the show that I really admired was the scenes in Stalag Luft 3. And I'm glad they did that because, as Donald Miller points out in his book, the reality was for a lot of these bomber crews was months, years of captivity. And I think they did a pretty good job showing the captivity and probably correcting some of the misconceptions that might be presented by the likes of The Great Escape and Hogan's Heroes, both of which I adore and grew up watching. But, I think there was that sort of harsher reality, and particularly those final episodes of showing what Germany was like in the final years of the war.
I'm going to say overall I enjoyed the series in spite of everything we've said. I enjoyed the series. I shed a bit of a tear at the end like I always do at the end of these things when they talk about the real people and what happened to them. So I'm going to say I enjoyed the series.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I only watched the last episode last night and it's been out for several weeks. I think it's telling that I wasn't rushing out to grab every episode as soon as it appeared. Yeah, so I think, and it was a long time coming. It bounced all over the place, this documentary, in terms of the production.
Look, you raise a good point there. So there's the time that it was in production, which was literally, I'm going to say it must have been close to a decade.
Yeah.
And also, I must admit, and maybe this is unfair, but I went into watching it with the expectations of a Band of Brothers or a Pacific for the air.
Yeah.
And it was unfair.
It was unfair to compare the Pacific to Band of Brothers. I love the Pacific. It's my favourite of the three. But I'm in the minority there. Other people found it a bit disjointed compared to Band of Brothers. Even it came out almost a decade after Band of Brothers. So we're talking 2001, 2010, and now 2024. That's a long stretch for three series. Overall, I think it was well worth having. I think it's going to draw a lot of people to the subject. My 16-year-old son, is now obsessed with the air war, and he wants to know his great-great-uncle was killed as a bomb aimer in the Second World War, and he wants to know all about him. So I think it's going to bring a lot of people to the subject. It could have been done a little bit better, but I think it's still a worthwhile addition to the collection.
Yep, that's fair enough. And look, if it gets anyone to read Donald Miller's book, it's a good thing because it's a big book, but it is absolutely exquisite.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You mentioned The Great Escape and moving on to other things. It was the anniversary of The Great Escape this week. Interesting. It's one of those chapters of history that's been probably defined by the movie, and the movie was loosely accurate, but mostly not. I think the interesting thing was it drew attention to the plight of POWs. We've seen two things at the same time, coincidentally. Masters of the Air focusing so much on the plight of POWs, but also the anniversary of The Great Escape. And, I think we can move past this pretty quickly, except to say that it's something I've been doing a lot of work on my book last year, The Kara Breakout, was all about Japanese prisoners, which gave me a bit of an insight into Japanese and Italian prisoners. But I think it's something, the plight of POWs is something that is still yet to be fully explored. I know that Christina Toomey wrote a fantastic book several years ago, the name escapes me, but about how Australian prisoners of the Japanese who survived, how they came home and were in many ways quite emasculated and how they struggled to fit back into society. So I think it's a fascinating aspect of warfare. In your work, have you come across much to do with POWs?
Look, not a whole lot myself, but I've actually just coincidentally finished reading Kristen Alexander's great book called Kriegies, and it's about the Australians who were in Stalag Luft 3. So the same camp as the Great Escape occurred in. And look, it's another great book. But I think one of the things that really occurred to me as I was reading that, she, I suppose, takes a bit of an emotional history kind of focus, which is a small sort of subgenre of academic history that focuses on looking at how people experience the past through feelings. And she focuses on that very much in her book. And yeah, I think I'd never really contemplated that sort of the emotional experience of being a POW. And, you know, I mean, you think about these guys, particularly so the airmen who have survived against all the odds, we've got to say. I mean, to survive, and I think Masters of the Air did depict this well, to get out of a bomber that was tumbling out of the sky on fire, you know, is a remarkable feat in itself. To parachute from 25,000 feet, survive, you know, being accosted by German civilians who are angry about being bombed, and then put into a prison camp. I mean, that must have been a traumatic ordeal. And these guys didn't have access to counsellors or, you know, anyone to talk about their
family. And they didn't know when the war was going to end. It's easy in hindsight to say, oh, well, you got shot down in 44, you've got less than a year to go. They didn't know that at the time.
They didn't know the Allies were going to win. And one of the points Kristen makes in her book is the amount of time that the letters, because she used a lot of collections of letters, and so she's looking at the dates between when, so these guys are writing home to their wives and parents and things, and we're talking literally 6, 7, 8, 9 plus months between communications, you know, from prisoner of war camps.
And you can see why they were so excited when the mail came and their name was read out, if it's been months since you've heard from
absolutely you know. And if parents or wives mentioned something that was concerning, you were literally half a year minimum, if not more, to, you know, resolving that with an answer. Or
well, you see now why Christina's book, I've just spotted on my shelf actually, it's called The Battle Within. Look up Christina Toomey's book about prisoners, Australian prisoners of the Japanese, and how they struggled to fit back into life. But you can see why. It must have been, emasculating is a word that she used a lot. And you can see why they're so far away. They're not participating in the war anymore. So there's questions about how, you know, what do I tell people when I get home? And they're only hearing from friends and family rarely. Yeah. And often, let's not deny it, often they're getting the Dear John letter that I've moved on. And, you know, so your family won't be waiting for you when you get home. I think it's a fascinating aspect of the war that we need to explore a little bit more.
Absolutely. And look, ironically as well, captivity meant that these guys more often than not survived. You know, their odds of surviving in captivity was, you know, far greater than surviving on future missions. So
we should point out, of course, that the prisoners of the Japanese were in a very different experience from those in Europe.
Yeah,
two very different stories, but both worth telling. So hopefully they will get more told as the years go on. Speaking of anniversaries, also this week, a couple of important World War I anniversaries. The naval battle at Gallipoli. Again, probably a chapter that doesn't get enough attention, particularly here in Australia. We're very focused on the Anzac landing. But the naval battle, which of course was the point of the Gallipoli campaign. We've been to Gallipoli together, Michael. We stood on that peninsula. You look out at the waters of the Dardanelles. And considering what a disaster Gallipoli was, it's easy to forget that it was all about that glistening, narrow little waterway. And, you know, for those that don't know the history, on the 18th of March, the British and French sent 16 obsolete warships into the old and crappy warships into the Dardanelles and basically got hell blown out of them by the Turkish forts and mines in the straits. And it's what precipitated the disaster that was Gallipoli. I mean, we've got a whole series of a special coming up on Gallipoli starting in a few weeks' time, which we'll deal in detail with this. And the first episode is on the naval campaign. But, Michael, it just illustrates to me on day one, the Allies had an insight that this was all going to go very badly when they lost 4 ships out of the 16. And then it just, that was actually probably the high point. It got worse from there. After all these years and all the work you've done, how do you look back on Gallipoli now and these opening days, and you know, how does it sit with you as a historian?
Yeah. Well, it's actually, I think there's an interesting link between this and Masters of the War and the 8th Air Force, and that is this belief that pops up at times in modern military history that you can win a war by air or sea power alone.
That's a great point.
And, you know, the naval battle at Gallipoli, as I understand it, was based on the, I suppose, aspiration of using these clapped-out warships basically to sail through the Dardanelles and essentially pull up off Constantinople and aim the guns, and then the Turks would surrender. Now, I mean, that's doubtful in itself, but beyond that, as a number of historians have pointed out in recent years, even had the Turks surrendered, it is unlikely that it would have had any impact on Germany and Austria-Hungary.
Yeah, it's harebrained. The whole scheme, even if it worked perfectly, which it was never going to, even if it had worked, that it was based on false assumptions, it was based on wishful thinking, the idea that this was a backdoor to Germany, that it would topple the enemy would fall over in House of Cards. It was just, even had it worked, and then, of course, this was the opening day, effectively, of the campaign, of the proper campaign.
Yeah.
And it just fell apart so quickly. And they should have taken a lesson from this, that it was that Gallipoli was not going to go well. And they should have packed up and left before a single boot hit the shore.
Absolutely. And look, the air commanders, the strategic bombing commanders, American and British, of the Second World War were guilty of the same misplaced assumptions.
Air
power could win war.
It's something that perhaps they didn't touch on it enough in Masters of the Air, but the answer to the question of why were they sending up bombers without fighter support was that bombers are going to win the war on their own.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to say as well, we should move on from Masters of the Air, but it's top of mind at the moment. That was a unique period in history, that the only time in history that planes would go up and do this sort of thing. And in some ways, Gallipoli was the same. This notion that we can send in a navy and overcome an entire nation just with naval power. Mm. I mean, it seems fanciful when we look back on it, but the British and French navies believed that they had the capability to knock an entire nation out of the First World War.
Yeah, and look, I think that probably comes from a pre-modern understanding of warfare where it was possible for decisive battles to decide the outcomes of wars. I mean, British naval strategists possibly would have been thinking of Trafalgar.
Yeah.
Others might have thought of battles like Waterloo or Gettysburg that did seem to largely determine the outcome of a war. The problem is what changes with the Industrial Revolution is that warfare becomes total. And you don't just have a finite-sized professional army or navy in the field that can be conceivably defeated in a day. You have an entire nation, and that nation's population and its entire economy that's committed to this war effort, and there's just no way that you can wipe it out in a day. And that's why I think the notion of a decisive battle it's pre-modern. It's something that, that didn't survive the Industrial Revolution, and it's why wars are now war now takes time, years in the case of the world wars.
If we hear Hearts and Minds one more time about what what soldiers on the ground are trying to do. But it's a fantastic point. And it was based on the misconception, the British arrogance, that Johnny Turk would run at the first at the first sight of a shiny British bayonet. Johnny Turk would turn around and run. And we see this throughout the Gallipoli campaign, this misunderstanding of what a strong enemy the Turks were. And even more than a century down the track, when we talk about it through a very Allied lens, what we could have done differently. Mm. If we'd just gone left instead of right on the day of the landing, if the British had more reinforcements at Helles. And we talk about it all, what we could have done differently to win the whole thing. But at the end of the day, the number one factor that stopped us from winning at Gallipoli, as is the case on most battlefields of the world, is determined enemy resistance. The main reason that the attacks didn't work, that the landings were a disaster, that the naval battle didn't succeed, brilliant Turkish defence. And we shouldn't take that away from it. They weren't perfect, and especially in very strong in defence, not so good in attack. And there's numerous examples of the Turks making horrendous, costly, bloody mistakes. But I tell you what, in terms of defence, they fought for every inch of the ground, and that, in my opinion, that's the main reason that Gallipoli was never going to succeed.
Mm, absolutely. And the tragedy, of course, is that even if it did, it probably wouldn't have shortened the war by a single day.
Exactly, exactly. Never should have happened. I don't have a good word to say about Gallipoli, except, I should add to all this, the courage of the men in the trenches. It's just, they pulled off something remarkable in spite of what was going on around them, not because of it. So we never take that away from the men who fought there. Also this week, Michael, 21st of March marks the beginning of the German Spring Offensive. Again, a really important but potentially overlooked chapter of, I've just invented a word there, underlooked, use that in your next book, an overlooked chapter of the First World War, the huge German attack in the March and April of 1918. A huge effort to sort of win the war in one fell swoop before the Americans arrived in any number. We won't go into all details about the German Spring Offensive. There's a number of podcasts I'll release. I've actually just released a special on this channel, an interview with Paul Reed about the German Spring Offensive. So go and listen to that for all the details. But a defining moment for Australia in the war as well, because Australian units were brought. So the Germans attacked and overran British units predominantly. The Australians were not in the line at the time, which is what saved them from being caught up in the early days of the Spring Offensive, and then counterattacked, notably at places like Hasbrook and, in particular, Villers-Brentno, the place where the Australian National Memorial is, you know, considered the key Australian battle on the Western Front. I mean, the Spring Offensive, and there's also battles like Dernancourt, which was the largest attack Australia faced during the war. That's why that one's a little bit less known. But some pretty defining moments for Australians in the First World War. I'm also going to go on record and say that I think Australia's most important military year in our history is 1918, where we, particularly the counterattacks that occurred after the German Spring Offensive and from August 8 onwards, when Australia was with the Canadians spearheading the British advance. I think 19 is our most important military year, but probably the one that gets the least attention. And hopefully an anniversary like the start of the German Spring Offensive shines a bit more of a light on what was going on the Western Front in 1918.
I think you're right there. It wasn't the costliest year in the First World War for Australia. That was 1917, of course, with Passchendaele, which was a devastating year for most dominions of the British Empire, as well as Britain itself. But I think you're right. 1918 year, it's the only time in Australia's history where Australia had a sizable military force on the main front and in the main part of the main front, I suppose you could put it, and played a role.
Certainly, and fighting against the main enemy.
And fighting against the main enemy. Certainly didn't win the war single-handedly.
That's true, Michael. I've read histories that talk about how we won the whole war.
Well, you know, it was a coalition effort. It was an imperial coalition, but, you know, we're spearheading some really, really important battles. One of the most interesting sort of factors, I think, that comes out of the Spring Offensive and the campaign that follows the Allied campaign in the Hundred Days is that these were armies that had fought for 3.5 years in static positions. They were made up largely of conscripts who'd only ever experienced trench warfare. And when I looked at it for my research on the air war over the Western Front, one of the things that struck me was that basically the learning had to start all over again. How do we fight a war of movement? Because all of these really carefully laid structures for things like observing artillery fire and coordinating attacks is completely different in a static trench warfare situation to a mobile, fluid, open battle,
A great point. And the two T's, technology and training, that's what had really advanced. If you say, why were the Allies able to pull off victories in 1918 that they didn't seem to be able to achieve in 1916. Just the training of the men, the technology that was employed. It wasn't me that said it, but I've used this many times, particularly when I'm walking a battlefield with people to explain it to them, that in 19... It's a slight exaggeration, but not by much, that in 1914, a Napoleonic soldier would have recognised what was going on. Large armies advancing towards each other, mostly infantry,
artillery,
a little bit of artillery, firing over... Firing directly, direct fire of artillery means you can see what you're shooting at, as opposed to what it would become later in the war, where they're firing from miles behind the line at targets that are marked on maps. So in 1914, a soldier, a Napoleonic veteran, would have recognised what he'd seen. By 1918, a modern soldier today would recognise what they're seeing. They're seeing tanks on the battlefield. They're seeing indirect fire from artillery. They're seeing a limited amount of air support. They're seeing much better communication, and they're seeing independent fire and movement of independent platoons, which I think was one of the big changes by 1918, that that platoons, both in terms of how they were armed. So the best example, I've used this before, forgive me if you've listened to the podcast, but there's a famous photo of, I think it's the 24th Battalion on the 1st of September at Mont Saint-Quentin, just before they go into the line. It's a single unit of men. Do they call it a platoon? I think I say a platoon. Yeah. About to go into the line. There's 9 men. Yeah. In that photo. A platoon's supposed to have 30 men in it. There's 9. So it shows a couple of things right there. Firstly, the huge attrition. So they're at 1/3 strength, the battalions that were going in. But though in those 9 men, 3 of them are carrying Lewis guns.
Yeah, right. So that mobile firepower.
So this is the thing that we always talk about. So the numbers were way down of the men, but the guns weren't disappearing. So a Lewis gun, so those 3 guns had probably been allocated for the platoon of 30 men. So 1 man in 10 would be carrying a Lewis gun. The fact you've only got 9 men in the platoon now, you've still got 3 Lewis guns. So in effect, the 9 men are a very small fighting unit, but they're incredibly heavily armed. And for the first time, they can be independent. They don't... In 1916, if there was a German machine gun that hadn't been taken out by the barrage, what are you going to do about it? You can't radio back and ask for more artillery to be dropped on it. The only thing you could do is what pretty much happened, and scores of Victoria Crosses were given for men taking them on single-handedly. That was obviously still going on in 1918, but the unit was operating much more independently and had its own firepower with it in terms of many more Lewis guns, rifle grenades, close mortar support. And so for the first time heading into 1918, units would do what they would do today. They would be fairly independent in terms of making their own decisions within their sphere of the battlefield and being able to act on it. So, I think, as I said, it's a slight exaggeration, the Napoleonic versus modern soldier, but it's not too far off the mark. And I think the German spring offensive and the battles that came after it illustrates so much how people, you know, how fighting had advanced. So if you're listening to this and you're someone that holds the belief that the First World War was all about men marching slowly into machine guns, read a couple of books about 1918 and you'll be absolutely amazed by what you see and the links to the Second World War and onwards to today.
Yeah, those battles of 1918 definitely have a very modern flavour.
Yeah, they absolutely do. We're going to finish up soon, but just one quirky little thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap it up, Michael, is that this was last week. There was a news article in Arran, an island in Scotland. They found a propeller from either a B-17 or a B-24 in a field in a potato sack in an area completely unrelated to where they, you know, there was any evidence of an air crash or anything like that. A little mystery. Any thoughts? You're an aviation man. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I when you sent me this, I thought, you know, this is pretty... Well, I must admit, initially I thought, you know, there's probably bits and pieces of aeroplanes all over Europe, let alone the UK.
Let's read the article so we understand what's going on. A propeller thought to be from a Second World War plane has been found buried in a peat bog in Arran. The blades thought to be from a B-17 Flying Fortress or a B-24 Liberator were found wrapped in potato sacks during peatland restoration work at Cor A Budrane. Aircraft crashed in the area during the conflict, but the discovery falls outside of 2 known sites. Heritage bosses have launched an investigation into the find.
Yeah, so I looked into this a little bit more, and it is curious because Arran is, as I discovered, is pretty remote off the west coast of Scotland. There's 3 known air crashes there during the Second World War, Liberator, B-17, and I think it was a Lockheed Lodestar, which is a transport plane, but I think they're pretty confident the propeller's not from that. So the Liberator crashed in 1943, being ferried from the US, so which is depicted in Masters of the Air, the North Atlantic flight route, and the B-17 crashed on a training flight in 1944. In the same area, bad weather, fog, basically both pilots flew into the side of a mountain.
Bad weather and fog and rain and wow, who would have thought?
Not an ideal place to be flying pre-GPS at low altitudes. The curious thing they're saying is that it's in a potato... The propeller was bound up in potato sacks, and I think they found it in a peat bog that they were draining.
So it's been discovered by someone previously. Obviously.
Well, you know, this is, I mean, for me, it seems like it's probably a souvenir that someone's picked up and, you know, they've, for whatever reason, either they've hidden it because it was, you know, not, you weren't permitted to be taking the, those items and those souvenirs, or, you know, they were dragging it across the bog. I mean, a propeller's a, you know, there's photos of it in the article. Yeah, absolutely. You know, these things are not easy to carry and, you know, maybe if someone's lost it in the bog accidentally. When archaeologists find multiple items together, what it does is often allows them to contextualize and date things. So, I mean, the first thing I'd be doing is looking at, well, when are these potato sacks dating from? You know, because that'll give, I think, a bit of context as to how the propeller blades got there. But, yeah, the rest of the debris fields, apparently I actually did a bit of a deep dive on this last night. It was on Google Earth. And, you know, there are debris fields that are scattered quite widely. Of course, these aircraft hit the mountainside going at full speed. And, you know, there are debris fields spread, but they're quite a distance from where the blade was found. So the blade didn't get there by itself, if the potato sacks didn't suggest that in themselves.
Well, it's an interesting mystery. I look forward to hearing what they come up with as time goes on. But, Michael, it's been great. Thank you so much. It's been good just to get you in here and chat about some of these interesting things that are happening. We'll certainly do it again in the future. But thank you for coming on the show and sharing your insights.
Thanks, Matt. I look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.